I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. I figured a new Steve Burgess book would be funny, full of wry observations we've come to know him for throughout his many years as a feature writer and columnist. The book, Reservations, The Pleasures and Perils of Travel, is not just a funny book, but it's also informative. It takes a serious look at the real cost of our holidaying, especially when a lot of us go someplace because it's cheap. But it can be exploitative to those who live in the places where we go. Not to mention justifying using all that fuel, whether by land, air, and sea, when we're in the midst of a climate crisis. The book is also personal and introspective. We see through Mr. Burgess's travels how much he learns about himself, especially when he finds himself elsewhere with somebody else. Steve takes us to all the places that have meant a lot to him over the years, whether it's the month he spent in Japan or his visits to Rome. Steve Burgess is a writer and broadcaster who, among other honors, has received two Canadian National Magazine Awards. We'll take some time to reflect on his broadcasting career as well. It was on CBC Newsreel that I remember him first from when he hosted a talk show there. He is a contributing editor at the TIE and is the award-winning director of documentaries. His previous book, Who Killed Mom, was published in 2011, the first time he appeared on this program. His work has been featured in sundry publications, including Reader's Digest, Maclean's, and the Globe and Mail. This new book is from Douglas and McIntyre. We spoke 12 days ago with Steve joining me from here in Vancouver. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Steve Burgess. Mr. Burgess, good morning.
My pleasure to be here.
As I just told you, have enjoyed this book a lot, and it's because I've always enjoyed your writing. I remember the TV show that you referred to on the in the book, the CBC show that you did. That's what, 25 years ago now?
Boy, oh boy, it's so sad, you know, when someone comes up to me in the street and says they remember my show, I just think you shouldn't admit that, you're dating yourself. But it aired from between January of 2000 to May of 2003.
Oh, yeah. And see, that you actually refer to this in the book, that because of when it aired, it predates sort of the YouTube era. So clips of the show don't exist anywhere, do they?
Not really. Like, I've got, listen, if anybody wants to, I'll put this out into the universe via you, Joe, is that I've got a box of VHS tapes of old shows, and I thought if I could get someone to dub those over into digital, and then I could maybe, and then somebody would have to teach me how to upload them to YouTube.
But yeah.
I could put a few of the old shows on YouTube, you know?
I remember that show because there were so many great guests. You were great on it. And that's the thing that as I was reading this book, I wish that your career on the air was longer. Do you wish that as well?
Well, yeah, I certainly did at the time. And, you know, I mean, honestly, if for nothing else, it was nice to have steady work, right, mm-hmm. with a real paycheck. Because as a freelance writer, you know, you don't, that's a luxury. But the other thing was, it was fun. It was a lot of fun doing that show. Got to meet a lot of great people and got to work with great people. So, no, absolutely, I was hoping that there would be something to come after it. But, you know, look, pardon me, you know, I don't want too much bitterness to creep in. But it's kind of like we were out in Vancouver, kind of in the boonies, right? And the decision, this was a News World show. Mm-hmm. And the decisions for News World were being made in Toronto. And I don't think they paid a lot of attention to us out there. So after our show was off, we were just kind of, I guess we were kind of forgotten out there. But you know, those of us who did the show, we were very proud of it. And thought, you know, and I still keep hearing from people who really enjoyed that show.
Yeah.
Which was called At the End, by the way.
That's right, which I'll mention in the introduction. So before and after that show, after that show, you have done a great deal of writing, but before that, did you write as well?
Oh, yeah. My writing career started basically in 1993. I came to Vancouver to be a disc jockey at 14 CFUN, favorites of yesterday and today. And then I was there for 5 years. Management kind of got disenchanted with me, I think. They didn't really think I was a team player. So, you know, remarkable coincidence. I had just started, my first article was published in the Vancouver Sun in June of 1993, And then in the Saturday Review section, mm-hmm. and I started getting more articles published in the Vancouver Sun. It was great. And then one day, September 1st, 1993, I got a phone call saying that an article that I'd submitted to Maclean's was going to run on the back page where Alan Fotheringham usually ran. And it was my big breakthrough as a freelance writer. And then that afternoon, I got summoned to the manager's office at CFUN and fired. So it was just kind of like, oh, okay, this is kind of an obvious signpost here. I guess I'm not supposed to do radio anymore. I'm supposed to write. So, and then I'm pushed on from there.
And I, for one, am glad you have written, because I'm such a big fan, as you know. I think I've told you every time I read something that's moved me. I try to send you a note and tell you how good that was. And I'm sure people come up to you and say how envious they are of your talent to write. I mean, do you get that a lot?
I wouldn't say I get it a lot, but you know, it's nice. It's very, very nice when, because writing obviously is a lonely thing, and you're sitting there. Maybe if I think that I came up with something good, something that made me chortle or whatever, that doesn't, like, it's not like standing on stage in front of an audience, and so you don't really know. And then, so when someone comes up to you and says they really appreciated something you wrote, that's a really nice feeling. I just was grocery shopping today at No Frills, and somebody mentioned that they liked the column, and it's a nice feeling.
Yeah, there are many times in reservations that I laughed out loud. Just clever turns of phrases, clever lines that you invoke that made me laugh a lot. When you write about traveling, as you do through this book, there are a lot of people who might think that traveling is an indulgence, that it's not good for the planet. I guess you do sort of make the argument that it can be, but the benefits are also there, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's the central dilemma of the book, you know, that I'm looking at, is that, okay, you know, obviously I travel a lot, obviously I love travel, and if I tried to tell people not to travel, I would come off like a giant hypocrite, and rightly so. But the thing is, it's just, there are issues now that travelers didn't really have to consider back in the day. And one of the unfortunate things about, well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great things about living in Canada. One unfortunate thing about living in Canada, if you want to travel the world, you almost always have to do it by a long-haul flight. Mm. And, you know, talking to Giulio Mattioli at the University of Dortmund, he pointed out that those are the big emitters. Short-haul flights are relatively minor emitters of carbon. It's the long-haul flights that we take from Canada. Those are the kind of things that really pump out the emissions. And so, yeah, no, I mean, if you're going to be aware, you have to be aware of the fact that our travels are not quite as simple as they used to be.
And so you're talking about airplanes, but, I mean, cruise ships are no better, right?
No, not really. Although, this is another thing. I mentioned, by the way, and I mentioned Giulio Mattioli a lot, because he was just a great source. He was one of those people that someone told me about him, and I contacted him, and he was just, you just love to have a source like this for the book, because he was so patient. I kept coming back to him with more and more questions, and his point of view is, I mean, he really was somebody who I really came to trust, and his opinion, you know, to value. But anyway, when I was mentioning cruise ships, he said, look, you know, he wasn't going to make a defense of cruise ships. He wasn't going to tell me that cruise ships are great. But he said, look, a lot of people who point their fingers at cruise ships and say, oh, cruise ships are so bad, they are behaving in ways that are equally irresponsible environmentally just by taking long flights. Yeah. Like by doing, you know, jumping on a flight to, you know, two flights to Rome or whatever, I'm not being any more environmentally friendly than someone on a cruise ship is doing.
And you've never been on a cruise, right?
I never have been on a cruise. I'll tell you, this didn't show. I don't think this showed up in the book. Sometimes I forget what I put in the book and I didn't and what I didn't. But I actually went down to the cruise ship terminal and asked if I could at least get a tour of a cruise ship. And they kind of looked at me like I was out of my mind and politely pointed out that what I was asking was the equivalent of going down to the airport and asking if I could get onto a 747 and get a tour. You know, and I realized they were completely right. So, no, I've never been on one.
Even after watching Below Deck?
I love Below Deck, you know. I haven't watched a series in a while, but why is it that Below Deck is so compelling? You don't care so much about the people who rented the boat. It's not like so much Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, although it is a glimpse into how tasteless people with money can really be, you know. There's so many clowns that rent those yachts. But it's all about the Below Deck drama, you know, the high-stakes drama of the third stewardess who doesn't know how to fold the towels and look like a swan, you know.
I've never seen the show, but because I try to follow pop culture, you know, I hear references to it all the time. And
it's just one of those shows. It's just one of those shows that reminds you of Henry Kissinger, apparently. Oh, maybe Kissinger didn't say it first. Yeah. Somebody about university politics. The politics are so vicious because the stakes are so low. And that's when you're watching Below Decks, that's the feel you get. It's like you couldn't get much more low stakes than the kind of petty feuds that are happening below decks, and yet you're just sort of transfixed by them, you know?
Yeah. So maybe that's what I'll do this weekend. I'll watch a couple episodes.
And watch a few Below Decks.
Yeah, I'll call you. You know, as a kid, I liked Love Boat. And, you're talking about obnoxious rich people and the sort. You saw some of those sometimes, and that was fun to watch, you know?
And that really transformed the industry.
Yeah,
it did. The industry never had that kind of free advertising before.
Yeah.
And cruise ships were simply not part of a large segment of the travel world before the Love Boat came on the air.
Yeah.
It was much more of a niche thing. And the Love Boat really helped to kick cruise ships into high, I don't know, can you say high gear? Is that a mixed metaphor for a cruise ship?
I think so, yeah. Boats have gears, I'm sure. So there are a lot of facts and information in this book, and you know, I kept thinking to myself, you know, I took note of a number of things so that I could use it at the next dinner party I'm at. Are you that guy with it? You always have some fun fact for the rest of the people at the table?
I have more of them after I wrote this book, I tell you. You know, this is, again, this is sort of a backstage story of the book, is that, you know, I dedicated the book to David Beers, the founder of the Tai, and, you know, Beers has been trying to get me a book deal for a long time. He's really been acting as my unpaid agent, and he's just he deserves sainthood for that, as far as I'm concerned. But one of the other things that he did, and aside from trying to get me the book deal, was Dave kept trying to beat it into my head that I needed to do more than just tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's my inclination, is just, oh, I've got these great travel stories, I'm going to tell you a bunch of funny stories. And Dave was the one who was telling me, your book has got to be about more than that. And I was kind of dubious. I thought, oh, Dave, I'm not a great reporter, I'm not a great journalist, and he was kind of slapping me around and saying, come on, you can do it. You know, you've done this kind of thing before. So I started the process and quickly found that, yeah, I could track down a lot of this stuff. And it just made the book a lot more than it could have been otherwise, you know.
Yeah, so it's your story and stories of your travels, but it's also about the travel industry itself. Like you, Airbnb comes into focus in the book, and we learn about just the negative. Well, we live in Vancouver, so we know what the impacts are. But the impacts elsewhere, especially, are important to know, aren't they? I mean, especially those of us that have used it or that are thinking of using it in lieu of hotels, right?
And Airbnb is also, it's another one of those issues that it's really difficult to come down definitively on one side or the other. And I know a lot of people do. There are people who just love or hate Airbnb. But when you talk to people about it, it's just, look, there are people who will point out quite rightly that Airbnb provides a, a, an important service for people, and that it serves a genuine purpose. It serves a purpose to small operators, and it serves a purpose to people who are looking for a certain kind of accommodation. There's no doubt about it. It's just that you can't keep Airbnb in its little cage. You can't keep it in its little box. It has metastasized, and it is unbalancing our housing market. And that's not a small thing, you know. I was just blown away when I was doing the research and found a fact from a site called alltherooms.com that they pointed out that there are more Airbnb listings in the United States than there are homes for sale.
Wow.
And, I mean, imagine, like, when people are talking about a possible collapse of the Airbnb market, they're talking about an event that could potentially rival the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis in terms of cratering the housing market.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge deal.
Indeed. The relationship with Kyoko, it's a marvelous thread throughout the book, and I guess that's one of the names that you had to change in terms of privacy, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so
her real name.
Yeah, so for the purposes of our conversation and for people reading the book, she's referred to as Kyoko. As you were writing the book and you were reflecting on that relationship from about 20 years ago now or more, I couldn't help but think that, and I was wondering this as I was reading, do you as a person look back and see any personal growth, say, as a result of the interceding years?
Oh, it's a big, obviously a big question. I'll tell you one thing. When I look back, I realize that poor Kyoko was kind of, I mean, she was obviously hoping that our relationship would continue. And one of the things that I realized in hindsight that I was kind of figuring out at the time and got more clarity on is that I didn't really want to be in a relationship with anybody. I don't think I really make this clear in the book, but the fact is, it has been a long time. I've never had Kyoko was my last serious girlfriend, if you want to get personal about it, because I kind of figured out at that point, it's like, you know what? I kind of like being my own master and going my own way, and I don't really want to make the sacrifices that you have to make in order to be a good partner, you know? And everybody gets to make their own choice. I'm going out to my brother's wedding in June, and he's, happy as a lark that he found somebody, and I'm happy for him. But I look at that and I think, that's not what I want. Like I say, that's not exactly what the book was about, but that was kind of what I was figuring out when I was traveling with Kyoko, and it became more clear in hindsight. But it also, the other thing is, when I look back, I think I do mention this in the book, I'll dwell on it, but I do mention that when I look back, a thing that I regret when I look back on that relationship is that I was too paranoid about it, because I was too worried about Kyoko and how invested Kyoko was. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is going to end so badly, and I was so worried about that. And I didn't give her enough credit. You know, I should have realized she's a grown woman. And she tried to tell me that, too. So that's one thing. When I look back, I realized that I didn't give her enough credit at the time, and so I kind of feel bad about that.
So if I'm dancing around it for people listening to us, it's because I don't want to spoil it for people, because it is a through line in the book that I think the payoff is actually quite beautiful. I don't know if it's I don't know if it's beautiful for you or her, but I thought it's, as a reader, it ended as it it could have.
I'm glad to hear that. I'll tell you this time. I knew. One of the first things I knew about the book was I knew how the book was going to end. And I really did think that would be, I'm very glad to hear you say it, because I really did think that would be a great narrative to lay through the book. And like I said, I knew I knew what the last chapter was going to be.
Yeah, a couple chapters before that, though, the chapter ends. Sort of as a cliffhanger, then the next chapter is you're talking about something else, and I was trying to read that as quick as I could because I wanted to know what happened, you know, what happened in the coffee shop, you know?
Yeah. Right. There is that danger. It's like, stop talking about this other stuff.
Yeah. Did you ever try and find her in the course of writing this book?
I tried to find her a number of times over the years. And then, as I detail in the book, I tried to find her house again.
Yeah.
But unless I don't think I made any serious attempts while I was writing the book, because I kind of, at this point, I won't just say I've given up. It's pretty clear to me that wherever Kyoko is, she, you know, wants to remain where she is.
Right.
So I haven't tried to chase her.
Another story that you tell in the book is about this girl in Nepal, and I don't, how do you pronounce it? Quina?
There again, look, it's funny, someone was just asking me that today. That's another name that I changed.
I see. But how do you pronounce the name that's in the book?
Quina? Well, it's funny because I selected her new name from a list of Nepalese names that I found. I've never actually heard that name pronounced, but I call her Quina.
Quina, okay. And that story speaks to the connections that we develop, whether we want to or not, when we travel. Because, you know, you encounter somebody for a moment, and you talk to them, and you share some sort of interaction, and that obviously affects how you think about the people of the place that you've been to and the place itself. Because, I mean, you're thinking of Nepal years later in connection to that moment with her, right?
Yeah, and I think there are a couple of very different, you know, connected but different lessons from that experience. One is that, yes, like when the big earthquake hit in Kathmandu, I was really struck by what a powerful emotional impact that had on me that, I'm sorry to say, it's cruel to say, but it wouldn't have had if I hadn't been there and if I hadn't met people.
Yeah.
I would have said, oh, well, there's another earthquake somewhere. But in this case, it was like it was devastating. I was looking at places that I had seen and marveled at, and they were in ruins. And the people as well were, you know, some dead and many of them homeless, you know. It was shocking. But I think the other thing that comes out of that story is the fact that I go to Kathmandu and I meet this enthusiastic, ambitious teenage girl who wants to be a doctor, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm meeting this family, you know, and I'm a you know, someone who's meeting this wonderful family, and I'm not really taking into account that I am from another planet, and that they see me as being from another planet, and not only that, it's from a very wealthy planet compared to theirs. And the idea, this naive idea that I have, that I'm going to have some kind of relationship with them the way I might have a relationship with you or my neighbor, it's just not realistic. Because, you know, obviously, I'm going to appear to them as an economic opportunity. Why wouldn't that?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so they're going to see me that way. And so, yeah, what follows from that is kind of inevitable. You know?
I was going to ask you if it was a cautionary tale, but,
I'd say it is.
Yeah.
I think it is, yeah. I think it's a cautionary tale. I felt like it was.
I hate talking about money, but I mean, how much did you send?
You know, over the years, I'm not 100% certain because there were kind of two cycles in which I was sending money.
Yeah.
I think I sent money via Western Union maybe six times.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it might have been a couple of $1,000s at the most. and it might have been less than that.
Yeah. And, as you write in the book, you did write an article about the experience,
right.
And so you did send you sent that money as well, right?
Well, I sent part of that money. Yeah. I mean, I'm a writer, and I have to make a living as a writer. But that's one of the ways that I justified. I thought,
right.
Look, if you know, she's asking me for money. I made money writing about her, so it makes sense that I would send her some money.
Yeah.
Even though, like, on the other hand, it's like. I'm a writer, and that's what I, you know, it's not quite as straightforward as that, because, I mean, if you had to give your writing fee to everybody you ever wrote about, nobody would ever write.
Indeed.
Well, I just thought it made sense.
You talk in the book briefly about your relationship with Vancouver and what's kept you here and why this place has been home for so long. When you travel, I guess what's that phrase that it makes the distance makes the heart grow fonder? I guess wherever you've ended up, whether it's in Italy or Japan over the years and everywhere else in between, Vancouver still remains home, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And since, you know, I've lived here now over 5 years now. Long time. Obviously, a lot longer than I've lived anywhere else. And I've often had the sense that when you live in Vancouver, one of the great things is you get to go away and you have a great time. And when you're coming home, you're coming back to Vancouver. And this is the place I used to come to as my destination. And now it's where I get to go home. I will say, like, it's not that I go away and I think, oh, I'm coming back to Vancouver where we have absolutely everything, and everything is better. Because, you know, look, if you're spending time in Italy, you're going to feel bad about leaving the cuisine, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you're coming back to Vancouver and not thinking, wow, can't wait to, you know...
Costco hot dogs.
...about Italian food I was eating, you know? But, I mean, it's just... I always feel like when I come back to Vancouver that it's a privilege, you know? Privilege to be here.
Did you study photography?
No, I didn't. Hold on. I took a photography course in high school.
I see. Okay.
I took an art class in high school in which you could get credit for photography and everything. But it's a kind of a quirk of mine, and it sounds like a boast, but I've discovered that it's a double-edged sword. It's got a good side and a bad side, is that I tend to almost always be self-taught. Almost everything I've done, and it's partly just because I don't like taking instructions, and I'm stubborn.
Yeah.
And you know, I was, you know, when I was in Cub Scouts, I had absolutely no stars and no badges. I had a naked sleeve. I never earned a single badge or a single star because I was so inept. But also because I think I probably, you know, didn't want to be in Cub Scouts. But so I mean, the thing is, I'm not someone who takes instruction well. And that means there's a plus side to that. It's like you teach yourself to do something by doing it, and you develop a unique style, and that's great. But on the other hand, you miss stuff too. You know? I think that it's taken me a lot of time to learn lessons as a writer that I should have learned a long time ago. For example, the fact that David Beers was pounding into my head the kind of book that I should write,
yeah.
And I was resistant. And it's, again, that's part of that thing where it's like, oh, nobody can tell me what to do. Well, that's not always a good thing, you
yeah.
know. It's stubbornness and it can hold you back. So, yeah, it's a double-edged sword. But anyway, that's a long answer to the fact that, no, I never really had any serious photography training. I just tend to do things on my own. You know?
Because there are beautiful photographs, and I read the book online, so I don't know what the finished book looks like, but... on your Instagram and on Facebook, I've seen your photos, and they're just beautiful how you capture light and color and people and
places.
Yeah,
well, unfortunately, even though I would love to have had, I actually suggested early in the process, I kind of hopefully suggested that we could have photos of the book. I kind of knew we wouldn't because, you know, it's expensive for a
yeah.
publisher. You know, having good photos in a book picks up the cost of printing by a substantial amount. And so my hope is, this is my fondest hope, that maybe this book will really do well. And if so, they might come out with a special edition in which I would add photographs. You know, that would be great.
Yeah, that would be great, yeah. The other thing I was going to ask you, Steve, was, and I think you've already answered this, is what took so long between books? Because I loved your memoir, and that's over 10 years ago now.
It was over a dozen years ago. It came out in 2011. Believe me, Joshua, it was not for lack of trying. In the years between the first book and the second, I wrote 2 complete novels that nobody would look at. I wrote a complete nonfiction manuscript that never went anywhere, and I wrote a number of proposals. I've lost track of how many proposals I wrote. You're in the publishing industry, so you don't mind a little bit of inside baseball. I think one of the main things was that my first book, even though it got great reviews, it didn't sell very well. And my agent dropped me, publisher dropped me, and you sort of get a reputation as box office poison. You know, and I was kind of hoping that the fact that the book was so well received would make a difference, but it didn't seem to make much of a difference. And the other thing is, just to not to make it, you know, too much about other people, after Dave Beers kind of convinced me to write the book, my new book, the way it came out, I looked back on a lot of the proposals that I was writing, and I realized that they lacked that element that this book has, which is the reported element, the journalistic element. A lot of my proposals didn't really have that. And so part of it, obviously, was my fault that I wasn't really writing proposal. I'm not a very good proposal writer. That's unfortunately true. I'm not good at writing proposals, but also I wasn't really including the elements maybe that I should have. But for one reason or another, I've been trying to get another book in print for the entire period since that first book came out. So that's why this is a very joyful event for me that this book is out.
It's a very special book to Reservations it allows us, the reader, to think about our own relationship with travel and where we live especially. And you do it with such humor. And as I said a moment ago, just you give us so many facts and information. We're going to be I'll be the hit at my next dinner party, you know. The other thing I wanted to ask you is, do you think the Canucks will get past the first round of the playoffs?
Oh, man, didn't that question just change? you ask any of us 3 days ago or whatever, right. It was, no problem, and boy, oh boy, now I really have to wonder. Look, I'm sort of a fan of Casey DeSmith.
Uh-huh.
It's that just not Demko. He's obviously not Demko. Demko is a special guy. And I think that Casey DeSmith is going to give them very solid goaltending, but Nashville, you can see how determined they are, throwing themselves in front of pucks. I still think that the Canucks will prevail in the first round, but boy, oh boy, I'm not a betting man anyway. But even if I was a betting man, I wouldn't be putting a lot of money on it.
Steve, it's always a pleasure to read you, and you know I'm a fan, and it's been such fun to talk to you about this book because it is a special book, and I can see how you've put yourself in it, in a very special way, that I can't help but think that people will get something so enjoyable and be quite moved by reading it. So congratulations and good luck with this book. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks for your kind words, Joseph. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the support as well.
The book is called Reservations, The Pleasures and Perils of Travel. It's published by Douglas & McIntyre. Its author, Steve Burgess, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plato.